Today, we're traveling back to the 70s. It's 1974 in California's Bay Area. Richard Nixon, a former senator from the Golden State, is in the Oval Office. We're 6 years out from the Zodiac Killer's first murder, and his letters are still terrorizing San Francisco. And Americans have spent the last decade watching their leaders die. JFK, RFK, MLK. The ongoing war in Vietnam, which Nixon promised to end, has sparked political upheaval across the nation. There are race riots, draft protests, American flags going up in flames, an energy crisis, soaring inflation, the Cold War still simmering in the background. Government surveillance is at an all-time high, and people's faith in institutions is failing. The country wants change. And in the midst of everything, there's a 19-year-old college student, a sophomore at UC Berkeley with no real interest in politics, who grew up in the lap of luxury, with a childhood filled with green lawns, mansions, and country clubs. She spends her days picking out china at Tiffany's and dress shopping. Before the 70s are over, she'll disappear against her will and resurface as a national symbol of radical change. An anti-establishment voice for the people, carrying guns, committing felonies, and running from the FBI. But all these years later, we're still asking the question, did she believe in her new cause? Or was she just trying to survive? I'm Sarah Turney, and this is Disappearances, a Spotify Studios original. Every Thursday, I examine a new missing person case ripped from history. I want to better understand the many reasons people disappear and the impact their absences can have on those left behind. Today, I'd like you to meet the granddaughter of an American newspaper tycoon and the heir to her family's media fortune. In 1974, her kidnapping kicked off one of the most unbelievable scandals the country had ever seen, in a year that included Watergate. Her name is Patty Hearst.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement.
Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
I've said it before. A disappearance can be many things. It's a catch-all term we use when someone's there one moment, gone the next, and we don't know what happened to them. Sometimes the missing don't have a choice in the matter. They're victims of violence, trafficking, murder. Other times they do. They're runaways, outcasts, people who, for one reason or another, don't want to be found. But this story starts on one end of the spectrum and then appears to travel to the other. And everyone seems to have a different opinion on where it finally lands. It all depends on how you interpret the facts. It's February 4th, 1974. Patty Hearst and her fiancé, Stephen Weed, are at home watching television in their off-campus apartment near UC Berkeley, where they both go to school. Patty's 19 and a sophomore studying art history. Steve's 26, 7 years older, and a PhD candidate in philosophy. They met while Patty was 16 and in high school. Steve was her teacher. At first, Patty's parents, Randolph and Catherine Hearst, didn't approve of their relationship, but they've since come around. In fact, a few weeks ago, right before Christmas, the Hearst published an article in one of their newspapers congratulating the young couple on their engagement. It included a photo of Patty and Steve, dressed up and smiling for the camera, and announced that they plan to be married early next summer. It was a nice gesture, but it included details about Patty's personal life. And ever since the article came out, she's felt uneasy. She can't seem to shake the feeling that something just isn't right. Around 9:30 p.m., there's a knock at the front door. It's a young woman, petite brunette. She looks to be in her mid-20s. She says she got in a car accident and asks if she can use their phone. As she does, two men explode into the apartment from behind her. They're carrying pistols and a rifle and immediately attack Steve. They knock him to the ground, kick him in the face, and beat him with a wine bottle. One screams expletives as he tells Steve to keep his head down. Steve assumes it's a robbery. The operation is militaristic and carefully considered. The intruders barely need to speak to each other, and the whole thing is over in the blink of an eye. By the time Steve regains his bearings, he's badly bruised and alone. Patty's stuffed into the trunk of a car, speeding away. She's been bound, blindfolded, and gagged, dragged out of her own front door. And now the car's headed to a tiny apartment in Daly City, about a 40-minute drive away. By morning, reporters are camped outside the Hearst Mansion in Hillsborough, California, a wealthy suburb of San Francisco. The heir to America's largest media fortune has been kidnapped, and everyone wants to know why. An answer arrives the next day. A radio station in Berkeley receives a letter from Patty's abductors, a group called the Symbionese Liberation Army, or the SLA for short. The SLA made headlines back in November, when they committed their first act of terror. They shot and killed a school superintendent in Oakland with a cyanide-laced bullet, a black man named Dr. Marcus Foster. The SLA targeted him because they believed Dr. Foster wanted to mandate student ID cards in California schools, a narrative that the world eventually learns was built around a reporting error. The brutal, senseless murder horrified the public. In the aftermath, even groups like the Black Panthers and Weather Underground, who inspired the SLA's creation, denounced the assassination as reprehensible. Police arrested two SLA members, Russ Little and Joe Romero, back in January. After stopping them for a traffic violation, officials charged them with Dr. Foster's murder. When the rest of the group learns about the arrest, they set fire to their headquarters, a small apartment in Concord, and fled before authorities found the address. The group went into hiding for a while, until Patty's abduction, their second high-profile act. The subject line of the SLA's radio station letter reads, "Prisoners of War. Target, Patricia Campbell Hearst, daughter of Randolph Hearst, corporate enemy of the people." It says Patty will be given adequate accommodations and won't be harmed, so long as their demands are met. They want all future communications they send to be published in full, in the newspapers, and all other forms of media. If authorities try to rescue Patty, the SLA says they'll execute her without hesitation. The letter ends with the group's creed printed in all caps. "Death to the fascist insect that preys upon the life of the people." The Hearsts are understandably frantic and distraught. They have no idea who they're actually dealing with, how big the SLA is, who's behind it, or if their word can be trusted. All they know for sure is the group has killed before. 6 days later, the same Berkeley radio station receives another letter. This time, it's signed by a man who calls himself General Field Marshal Sin Q, and accompanied by a tape recording of Patty speaking, she addresses her parents. You can listen to the actual recordings online, but I'll read an excerpt. She says, "Mom, Dad, I'm okay. I had a few scrapes and stuff, but they washed them up and they're getting okay. And I caught a cold, but they're giving me pills for it and stuff. I'm not being starved or beaten or unnecessarily frightened. I'm kept blindfolded usually so that I can't identify anyone. My hands are often tied, but generally they're not. I'm not gagged or anything. I'm comfortable, and I think you can tell that I'm not really terrified or anything. And I'm okay." Patty goes on to explain that Russ Little and Joe Ramiro, the two men arrested for Dr. Marcus Foster's murder, they're innocent, just like her, prisoners of war between the government and its people. The SLA seems to be suggesting a prisoner swap. They'll trade Patty for Russ and Joe's freedom, but they probably understand it's a long shot. So they lay out another, more detailed demand. They want Randolph Hearst to distribute food to poor and working-class people throughout the United States. $70 worth of fruits, veggies, and dairy products to anyone who shows up at designated stores and presents proof of need. Food stamps, welfare cards, medical cards, disabled veteran statuses. They say the program must begin on February 19th, in 7 days, and the distribution of food should be scheduled twice a week, every Tuesday and Saturday, for a 4-week period. And it should be organized. They don't want people waiting in long lines to be fed. The next day, Randolph tells reporters the SLA's demands are impossible. He's desperately afraid for his daughter's safety, but he just doesn't have the resources necessary to make them happen, especially with so little time. But he says he'll spend the next 24 to 48 hours coming up with a counterproposal. It's not the reaction the SLA wants. Their response comes a few days later, when another tape recording arrives at an airport bus terminal in San Francisco. It's another message from Patty and Sinque. Patty's tone is different this time. She scolds the press and her parents for misrepresenting her abduction and for essentially portraying the SLA as a bunch of crazed lunatics. She says that this isn't the case. She's not being starved, beaten, or tortured. In fact, the SLA wants to return her safely. Her parents just need to cooperate with their demands. She also tells her parents to stop acting like she's dead, aka stop being so dramatic. Sinque tells Randolph, the people are waiting for his gesture. It's hard to pinpoint Patty's mental and emotional state from just listening to the tapes. Whether she's reading a script at gunpoint or whether she possibly means what she says. But it becomes clear. The Hearst will do whatever it takes to get their daughter back. On February 19th, Randolph launches an organization called People in Need, or PIN. Its leaders believe the program will be able to feed 100,000 people with a $2 million budget, 500,000 of which will come from Randolph's personal funds. The next day is Patty's 20th birthday, and another tape appears. Sinque says the number should be closer to 6 million to reflect Randolph's capabilities and the people's needs. When Randolph responds, he says he can't afford that much, but he's willing to raise more money. His reps offer to pay the $2 million upon Patty's release, and another $2 million in a year. There's no response from the group before the first day of PIN's food program on the 22nd. And it's a disaster. Its systems aren't set up to handle the turnout. Long lines and disorganization lead to riots and violence, people fighting over food in the streets. It's a dehumanizing experience for those who showed up hoping to feed their families. To add insult to injury, California Governor Ronald Reagan accuses the thousands of people accepting the food of aiding and abetting lawlessness. In time, PIN becomes more organized and effective, but the SLA doesn't seem to care. Another tape appears where Patty criticizes her parents. She says she doesn't believe that they're doing anything at all, and says the quality of PIN's food isn't good enough, comparing it to the meals she had growing up. On March 25th, PIN's last day, the program distributes food to 30,000 people. Representatives do the math and find they spend a total of $2.3 million feeding the hungry, $300,000 more than planned. And this is where the story reaches a turning point. It's easy to argue that the Hearsts have lived up to their end of the bargain. They've done what they can with the time constraints. They've acted on the SLA's demands and promised to pay millions more when Patty's released. So everyone wants to know, will the SLA let Patty go? The answer comes about a week later in another recording from Patty.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
On April 3rd, 1974, 2 months after her kidnapping, the SLA releases another tape recording of Patty Hearst, and its message shocks the country. She says, "I have been given the choice of one, being released in a safe area, or two, joining the forces of the Symbionese Liberation Army and fighting for my freedom and the freedom of all oppressed people. I have chosen to stay and fight." She goes on to say that she's changed her name to Tanya after a revolutionary who fought alongside Che Guevara in Bolivia. She ends with a famous line from one of Che's speeches, "Patria o muerte venceremos." Homeland or death, we will prevail. Soon, a photo circulates of Patty wearing military gear and holding an assault rifle in front of a red flag with a seven-headed cobra on it, the SLA's emblem. She looks nothing like she did in that December engagement photo, and no one really knows what to make of the 180, except for maybe the hearse. Patty's parents have access to a permanent megaphone to share their point of view. Randolph is the executive editor of the San Francisco Examiner, and crowds of reporters have been stationed outside their California mansion for weeks now. Many are there 24/7, camping in Winnebagos with grill sets and booths. All it really takes for the Hearst to hold a national press conference is to step outside their front door. After the initial shock wears off, they use their platform to remind the world that despite what they might have heard in those tapes, their daughter is a victim who's been brainwashed by her kidnappers. But soon, that narrative gets harder to believe. At 9 a.m. on April 15th, a branch of the Hibernia Bank in San Francisco opens to the public. At 9:40, four white women and one black man enter the building, wearing black trench coats and carrying semi-automatic weapons. The man disarms the security guard and tells everyone in the bank, about 20 employees and six customers, to get on the floor. Two of the female robbers head to the cash drawers, while another announces they're from the SLA. Someone points to Patty and says, "This is Tanya Hearst." The heist is over within 5 minutes. The SLA walks away with about $10,000 in cash. Two people are shot, but none die. Investigators speculate that the heist may have been a publicity stunt, a way for the group to display their influence over Patty. But the question remains, was she a willing participant? No one can say for sure. But the bank's automatic cameras capture over 1,000 pictures of the robbery. Her finger is very evidently on her gun's trigger. When the photos are played in succession as a film, lip readers suggest Patty confidently issued threats and ordered civilians to stay in line. Some reports have her yelling, in language more colorful than we usually have on this show, that if anyone puts their head up, she'll blow it off. Journalists ask a customer who was there that day if they thought Patty would have used her weapon. They respond, "Yes, absolutely." Before the month's over, the FBI issues arrest warrants for the SLA members involved in the heist. Everyone's charged with armed robbery, except for Patty. There's enough doubt about whether she willingly participated that the FBI only lists her as a material witness. But that doesn't stop the rumor mill. And thanks to those pictures from the bank, the SLA is no longer a faceless organization. 4 of its members have wanted photos. The day after the wanted photos are released, another tape appears that's a direct response to all the public discourse. Patty takes accountability for her actions in the robbery, saying no one forced her to participate. That idea, she says, is laughable. And she verbally attacks her family, calling them pig hearse, and her fiancé, Steve, an ageist, sexist pig. Meanwhile, with so many eyes on them, the SLA packs up their Daly City apartment and moves headquarters, narrowly avoiding capture. They're gone by May 1st. The FBI arrives on May 2nd. The next time Patty appears in public, it's in Los Angeles. She's with 2 SLA members, Emily and Bill Harris, a Midwestern married couple who met in college. Patty's become one of the most recognizable faces in America, so when she goes out in public, she wears disguises, wigs, sunglasses, hats. And strangers on the street still comment about how familiar she looks. By May 16th, it's been 3 months since Patty was first kidnapped. She sits in a van in downtown Los Angeles, alone, and acts as a lookout for the Harrises. Bill and Emily are in a sporting goods store, attempting to shoplift socks. Patty watches them through the glass storefront. When she sees Bill and Emily get into a confrontation with the store's clerk, she knows it's time to move. If the police arrive, they'll all be arrested. So she creates a distraction. She takes out a gun and unloads a full clip of ammunition into the storefront. Once it's empty, she takes out another rifle and fires some more. The chaos allows Bill and Emily to get away. They jump in the car with Patty and escape before police arrive at the scene. Incredibly, no one was hurt. FBI agent Charles Bates remembers that there were plenty of people passing by on the street. Patty could have injured or killed any of them. But the incident lets the LAPD know the SLA is in their city. The next day, the police find the group's latest hideaway. Some of their members are squatting in an apartment in Compton. SWAT teams surround the premises. The SLA doesn't cooperate with police demands and refuses to vacate. There are questions about which side shoots first, but soon, volleys of bullets rain in all directions. Officers pour gasoline onto the foundation of the building and light it on fire. Tear gas adds fuel to the flames, and the American public watches everything play out in real time because news stations are broadcasting the event live. Now, this is years before O.J. Simpson's famous car chase and the tragic shootouts in Waco, Texas. Thanks to new technology, it's the first time an event like this has been streamed straight into people's homes. And it's shocking. Before it's over, the LAPD empties an estimated 1,200 rounds of ammunition into the home. The building burns to a heaping pile of ash and debris. Every SLA member inside dies. Reporters wonder if Patty Hearst was inside the home. Police say they aren't sure, but that could just be for show. Some believe they would have never taken such drastic actions if they suspected Patty was in there. And she wasn't. Like so many others, Patty and the Harrises watched the bloodbath unfold on television from a motel room near Disneyland. What the world doesn't know yet is the dead SLA members account for half of the group. The Symbionese Liberation Army began as about a dozen 20-somethings who were almost exclusively white and middle class. It all started after some UC Berkeley students signed up for a prison program called the Black Cultural Association, where they tutored incarcerated men. After a while, they began to see these inmates as political prisoners of the government. When one of the inmates, a black man named Donald DeFries, escaped in 1973, the Berkeley students took him in. Together, they started the SLA and became even more radicalized. They practiced military tactics in the Berkeley Hills to prepare for their war against the US government, racism, monogamy, capitalism, and the prison industrial complex. They adopted Swahili names like Sinku and Tanya. who's still at large. Weeks after the shootout in LA, there's another audio tape from Patty. She delivers a eulogy for the SLA members killed that day. It starts with, "Greetings to the people. This is Tanya. I want to talk about the way I knew our six murdered comrades. Because the fascist pig media have, of course, been painting a typically distorted picture of these beautiful sisters and brothers." She then speaks about each of the fallen members, referring to them by their Swahili names. She speaks about someone named Cujo last, saying, "Cujo was the gentlest, most beautiful man I've ever known. Neither Cujo or I ever loved an individual the way we loved each other. Our relationship's foundation was our commitment to the struggle and our love for the people." Then she ends the eulogy with, "I died in that fire on 54th Street, but out of the ashes, I was reborn. I know what I have to do." She goes on the run. On August 8, 1974, Richard Nixon becomes the first American president to resign from office. After months spent denying his role in the Watergate scandal, recordings from White House wiretaps expose the truth. He was complicit, a willing participant. Meanwhile, the jury is still out on Patty Hearst. Ever since the shootout in LA, she's been on the run with Bill and Emily Harris. But many Americans are sympathetic to their cause. For the most part, the group's senseless murder of Dr. Marcus Foster has faded into the rearview. The SLA has gone from murderers, kidnappers, and terrorists to champions of the impoverished. Patty has gone from a kidnapping victim to a counterculture icon, proof that class divide can be bridged. Students hang "We Love You, Tanya" posters around campuses and hold rallies to express their support of the SLA. And so, Patty and the Harrises find people willing to take them in. They drive across the country, moving through New York, spending some time on a farm in Pennsylvania, and eventually making their way back to California. But with six dead and two in jail, Patty and the Harrises are basically all that's left. And by April, Russ Little and Joe Ramiro receive life sentences for the murder of Dr. Marcus Foster, so they're not getting out anytime soon. Patty and the Harrises manage to recruit a couple new members while they're in California. Still short on money and supplies, they turn to crime, small-time theft and robberies. They even set off some bombs in Northern California. On April 21st, 1975, four SLA members hold up a bank in Carmichael, California, while two wait outside in stolen vehicles. Armed and masked, they tell everyone inside to get down on the floor. A gunshot rings out, and one of the customers falls to the ground, a 42-year-old mother named Myrna Opsahl. A shotgun bullet hit her left side, and she's critically injured. They make off with about $15,000 in cash. Myrna Opsahl dies later that day. The FBI doesn't catch up to the SLA for another 5 months, more than a year and a half after Patty's abduction. Then, on September 18th, FBI agents see an opportunity and move in. At 1:15 p.m., agents arrest Bill and Emily Harris on the street outside a house they've been surveilling for days. About an hour later, they find Patty inside a nearby home with another fugitive, a woman named Wendy Yoshimura, wanted for her role in an arson bombing conspiracy back in 1972, unrelated to the SLA. Wendy reportedly surrenders immediately, but Patty walks away at first, out of the officer's view. Some agents suspect she may have been headed to a nearby closet to grab a gun, but Patty says she was just afraid of getting shot, so she ran away on instinct. After police threaten to kill Wendy, Patty reappears with her hands in the air. When the arresting officers ask what her job is, Patty says, "Urban guerrilla." She later lists the same occupation on her prison paperwork. By some accounts, Patty tells her attorney to send her love to all her brothers and sisters out there, and confides in a fellow inmate that she wished she'd never been caught. Faced with armed bank robbery charges and the felony use of a firearm, the Hearst hire their daughter a new attorney. And not just any attorney, one of the best defense lawyers money can buy. F. Lee Bailey, a man who will one day help get O.J. Simpson acquitted. and Patty begins telling a story that for many feels new, a departure from what they've been witnessing in the news. Patty says it's the story of what really happened behind closed doors. After her abduction, she was blindfolded and placed in a closet that wasn't even big enough for her to lie down in. She lived in a constant state of terror. Her captors threatened, beat, and raped her. She says she was kept in that closet for 57 days, deprived of food, sunlight, and any communication from the outside world. She needed to rely on her captors for everything, including the news. All the while, they fed her a steady stream of their group's messaging. When her blindfold finally came down and she was finally allowed out of the closet, she says it was like sensory overload, like she was on an LSD trip. It was the day of that first bank robbery, and the SLA apparently told her that her options were to participate or be killed. After the robbery, she says she felt like there was no going back. Unable to distinguish between reality and fantasy, the group had made her bed for her. And now she had to sleep in it. In testimony at trial, Patty says she was raped by Willie Wolf, the SLA member who took the name Cujo, the same one she said she'd fallen in love with in that taped eulogy a year prior. Patty's lawyers argue that she was brainwashed and abused. She acted out of fear the entire time. It didn't matter that her blindfold was eventually taken off and she looked free. She wasn't. The prosecution, of course, argues the opposite. They claim Patty was a willing participant who had many opportunities to get away or ask for help. They point to the bank robberies, the bombs, all the crimes she aided and abetted, the months she spent on the run, the tapes. Other members of the SLA, like the Harrises, also contradict some of Patty's statements. They maintain that her relationship with Willie Wolf was loving, consensual, and meaningful. And at trial, the prosecution finds new evidence to help make that case. Now, I don't know the logistics of how this actually happens, but during the trial itself, attorneys find a charm in Patty's purse, which they learn matches a piece of jewelry found in the ashes with Willie's body. And so they ask the jury, why would Patty keep a gift from her rapist? Ultimately, the prosecution wins their case. The jury finds Patty guilty of all charges, and a judge sentences her to 7 years in prison. But she won't even serve half of it. 22 months in, President Jimmy Carter commutes her sentence, and Patty walks out of prison a free woman. After her release, she marries and starts a family with one of the bodyguards hired to protect her during her trial. She retreats from the public eye for a while, only to re-enter the spotlight years later, having written a book about her experience called Every Secret Thing. In it, she reaffirms her innocence and outlines the abuse she says she experienced at the hands of the SLA in graphic detail. She goes on to be a very different type of celebrity. In the 90s and early 2000s, she walks runways for Mugler fashion shows in Paris. She stars in a number of films directed by John Waters, including one where she plays the mother of a terrorist who helps kidnap a movie star. And she raises show dogs and wins multiple top prizes at the Westminster Dog Show. Then, in 2001, Bill Clinton gives Patty an official presidential pardon, making her the first person to have ever had their sentence commuted by one president and crimes pardoned by another. It's a very different road than the surviving SLA members. Russ Little, one of the two men charged for Dr. Marcus Foster's murder and sentenced to life in prison, served 6 years before being retried and found innocent. As of this recording, Joe Ramiro, the other man charged, remains in prison and maintains his innocence. Other former SLA members have supported his claims. Emily and Bill Harris both pled guilty to kidnapping charges in 1976 and served all 8 years of their sentences. Then, in 2001, the September 11th terrorist attacks prompted U.S. authorities to reinvestigate old cases of domestic terror. After getting out of prison, separating, rebuilding their lives, careers, and their families, Emily and Bill are put back on trial in 2003, along with three other SLA members involved with the 1975 bank robbery where Myrna Opsahl was killed. Michael Borton, James Kilgore, and Sarah Jane Olson, all of whom Patty helped recruit. At trial, Emily admits to firing the gun that killed Myrna, but claims it was an accident. In fact, everyone involved says they never intended to harm anyone, though they admit their intention doesn't really matter. Michael Borton says, "The fact that Mrs. Opsahl was murdered unintentionally is of no consequence to the family, or the fact that we beat ourselves up more than anyone could. A woman is dead, and many people suffer from those consequences. I can offer nothing but my apologies." The SLA members are found guilty of second-degree murder, and each receive sentences of 6 to 8 years in prison. Though Patty was present for the robbery, she's granted immunity in exchange for her testimony against them. We're left with a lot of questions. What role did money, influence, and privilege play in this case? What's fair? What's true? I honestly don't know, and that's not for me to decide. Experts are still debating whether brainwashing is a real phenomenon or not, but that doesn't change the fact that agency doesn't always look how we expect it to. I wanted to cover this case because, for me, it's a reminder that nothing is black and white. Good intentions can have terrible consequences. Radical groups who kill in cold blood can raise more awareness for hungry and impoverished communities than the politicians elected and paid to serve them. Innocent people receive life sentences. Kidnapping victims make terrible mistakes. Accountability matters. Justice matters. But with every case I cover, no matter how the facts present themselves, there's always going to be a need to step back and ask myself, is it more naive to choose doubt or certainty? Thank you for listening. In the time it took you to finish this episode, 35 people disappeared in the United States alone. If you or someone you know needs assistance with a missing persons case, please visit seasonofjustice.org. Season of Justice is a nonprofit organization that provides funding to law enforcement agencies and families to help solve cold cases. For full disclosure, I am a member of the board. It's a great resource for both law enforcement and families in order to bring closure to those impacted by unsolved violent crime. You can find all episodes of Disappearances and all other Spotify Studios originals on Spotify. Disappearances is a Spotify Studios original. Our head of programming is Julian Boireau. Our supervising sound designer is Russell Nash, with Nick Johnson as our head of production and Spencer Howard as our post-production supervisor. Allie Wicker is our supervising editor, and Derek Jennings is our writing lead. This episode was written by Connor Sampson, edited by Natalie Pertzofsky and Maggie Admire, researched and fact-checked by Chelsea Wood, produced by Alex Button, with sound design by Alex Button. I'm your host, Sarah Turney. To hear more stories hosted by me, check out my other podcast, Voices for Justice.